He showed his hearers how the mourner could and should be comforted in the only possible way, for the so-called dead were not dead, they were very much alive, and could speak in precise, clear terms, just as he was then addressing his audience. That it was right and proper to do so was evidenced, among other things, by the great consolation which such communication brought to their bereaved in being able to speak once again with those whom they had thought had passed forever from their ken. That was what the founder of Christianity told his followers. How does that compare with the extraordinary and unnatural beliefs of the first and undivided Church? Strangely, indeed. As the present Church claims to be the lineal descendant of that early Church, it is simple enough to see the wide disparity between the teaching of Jesus and the queer collection of doctrines and dogmas now held by the Church. If the theorists wish to refer to the primitive Church, they must eventually go still farther back, and it will mean a wholesale reconstruction of their beliefs, with the equally wholesale elimination of the many religious practices which have no approximation to the truth nor any value whatever spiritually. The Church must in fact start de novo, sweeping the board clear of all the theological rubbish and accumulation which have been piled upon it during the passing of the centuries. If they were to study the life of the Master Christian even from the scanty chronicles that exist, and copy his methods, they would have something solid upon which to build their Christian unity. The theological forest has become obscured by its own distorted and too abundant trees. There was a time in history when men developed a passion for reforming the Church. At least, that is what they called it. The reforms which they introduced were mostly the outcome of muddled thinking, with very occasionally a minute move in the right direction. But in casting out some belief which was considered no longer tenable, they substituted others equally without truth, and generally caused so much hatred, not only of themselves but of their new ideas, that feelings ran high, and blood flowed, while the list of the martyrs grew. Of what use such reforms as those? The Church of the present time has grown highly organized. It is much concerned with affairs of the earth as they affect it ecclesiastically, but the great world of the Spirit is woefully neglected. The one institution on earth which, by virtue of its very claims and functions, should be most actively in communion with us is cut off and separated from us. The whole Christian Church is in a state of schism with us of the spirit world. To the great bulk of the clergy, the spirit world is a silent world of the dead. They cannot answer the straightforward questions of a despairing soul: what has become of my dear ones who have left this earth? Where are they? Why is there this cruel silence, and why cannot you, the appointed, self-appointed ministers of God's Church, give us, who are so deeply in sorrow, some real comfort, some truth? We do not want speculations, we do not wish now to hear about God's mercy, that will not dry our tears, nor stop their flow. We do not wish to hear quotations from the Scriptures about faith, nor to be given spurious comfort from a book hundreds of years old. Our loved ones passed from this earthly life this very week. Why turn to a book so old when we are speaking of now, this actual moment of time, within the week of our sad loss? You say to us, blessed are they that mourn, 3, for they shall be comforted. If you insist upon throwing that text at us, then where is that comfort? Give us the comfort, not some religious counterfeit. How would you, my dear friends, have answered such a despairing cry from the heart had you been in my position when I was on earth? Yet as a minister of the Church I should have been able to answer such an afflicted soul with the truth. Alas, I could not. All that I could do was call for the exercise of faith upon the part of the distressed one, and to have help and trust in God's mercy, backed by the powerful intercession of the true Church. For had not the departed soul been fortified by the rites of our Holy Mother the Church? Incidentally, so had I when my time came to depart, but I cannot say that those rites availed me anything whatever. What word of real consolation had I to offer when some sad soul came to me for help? I could not give of my knowledge, for of knowledge I had none. Whatever I might have guessed or thought privately, it was not my business to reveal what was in my mind concerning the afterlife, but to speak upon the church's teaching and authority alone, and the church had no statement to make. However secure I felt in other circumstances with the might of the church behind me, in such moments as these we are discussing, I realized to the full my helplessness through ignorance. I could talk freely and fluently upon the sacraments, upon the church's teaching concerning this or that. I could urge more faith upon the part of my suppliant, I could offer my own prayers which I can see now served precious little purpose because they were altogether upon the wrong lines. I could advise others to pray, too, and leave it for them to find the words of their supplication. My rejoicing at being a member of the one true church was, at such times as these, somewhat tempered, to put it mildly, when in cases of real spiritual need, the best I had to offer was empty hollow phrases upon stereotyped lines, and trust to time to dim the memory and heal the sore of affliction of those who came to see me. The founder of Christianity had more to tell his listeners about the welfare of the soul after the death of the physical body than have all the churches of Christendom this very day. Christian unity as envisaged by the clergy and laity is a state where the whole earth is conforming, more or less, to the one body of teaching, where the members of one persuasion are in communion with those of another. And would the earth be any the better for such unity? None whatever, for it would merely be a unity of error. Though the unity might endure for a measurable time, yet in the end it would be bound to be dissevered once again, and so repeat the whole performance of divisions and schisms and controversies. The church on earth at these present times is worn out because it has nothing to offer any thinking man or woman but lifeless doctrines. Indeed, the church itself is lifeless despite the appearance of activity that is to be observed. How shall the church be regarded? By results. What are they? The church is powerless to prevent wars upon earth because it has no influence with the governments of the earth. Were the churches to unite upon a common platform of no war, who in authority would listen? The religious teachers accept war as a punishment of God for the world's wickedness. And if such were the case, then it must be manifestly wrong to cry out against or condemn what has been declared as a just and divine punishment. Such are the tortuous, serpentine ways of the theologians. Christian unity is far more concerned with ancient ecclesiastical history, with valid or invalid orders, with ceremonial and ritual investments, with rubric, with church buildings and appurtenances, and with preferment and livings. The leaders of religion are occasionally to be observed rapping the laity upon the knuckles ever so gently because they do not attend the services in sufficiently large numbers, and because they profane the Sabbath with material enjoyments instead of packing the church and giving evidence of how virile religion really is. Viewed from the inside, there is religious intolerance and self-satisfaction. Viewed from the outside, from the spirit world, we can see just how much a mockery of the truth is orthodoxy. Hundreds of years of false teachings that have had to be set right with the unhappy victims of them in the spirit world. The institution that is supposed to send its members fully equipped for the journey into the great beyond, in fact sends its voyagers all ignorant of spiritual knowledge, ill-equipped in every way, and so often paralyzed with fear of what is to happen to them. If you wish to know whether the churches have failed, ask us of the spirit world, and we can provide you with a plain unequivocal answer in one short word, yes. If all the churches of the earth were to unite in their present state of ignorance, the failure would still continue. It is customary for ministers to cast their minds back wistfully into the past, to those days of religious unity which they call the Age of Faith. Let them turn their minds in another direction, to the age of fact acquired, secured, and proved, and casting all their theological speculations aside, base a real unity upon spiritual truth, for mighty is the truth, and it will prevail. One, it would appear that the Monsignor has not taken into consideration that religious knowledge evolves, and is essentially revelatory passed down from spirit. Given that three examples of major religions, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, have all turned their backs on further revelation and certainly do not seek out spirit communication, is it little wonder people are not getting their fair dose of truth? Two, a number of substantial sources exist of channeled material which have a large amount of what one might call the teachings of Jesus. The first of these, and what I would consider the most authoritative, because the lead spirit was indeed Jesus himself and his apostles, is the Paget Messages. This was delivered in 1914 to 1923 but only published from 1941 on, and remain very little known to this day, although there is enough material to fill four 400-page volumes. These books can now be obtained on Amazon Kindle and at Lulu. Subsequently, Jesus continued to deliver more material through a Dr. Samuels, which material is also to be found on many Paget websites. Very recently, Judas Iscariot has delivered a significant amount of material that was previously unknown. The Urantia book has a very large section, over 200 pages, of material on the life of Jesus, although it does not explain advanced spiritual laws, as was done through James Paget. Even the trilogy of Robert James Lee's can be considered to make a very reasonable effort to link the Bible to what one finds in the spirit spheres, illustrating that truth, while perhaps concealed by current Orthodox Christian thinking, still can be found in the Bible, if you read that book with a totally untrained or unbiased mind. 3. This passage was explained by Jesus, through Dr. Samuels here on June 1, 1955. Next headline is, Peace on Earth. We had made a brief pause in our labors, and we were enjoying what in our earthly days we should have called a day off. By we, I mean a small company consisting of some artists and musicians, all of them masters of their craft, my former religious superior, who was a prince of the church, my father, who was also a noted prelate of his times, but of a denomination opposed to mine, and lastly, my good friends and present colleagues, Edwin and Ruth. We formed a most pleasant company of companions. It would have done the hearts of advocates for religious unity on earth the greatest good to have observed my father and my former superior themselves in complete unity. They have become fast friends in these lands, and frequently meet beneath my roof. Indeed, my father has upon many occasions expressed his gratitude to my quondam superior for his care of me during the latter part of my earthly life, when he, as it were, stood in loco. Parentis. On the occasion of which I am now speaking, we had all of us temporarily abandoned our work, not, I would hasten to add, from any causes of disaffection, but by a prearranged plan we had so disposed our various activities and made the necessary provision where we were closely engaged, that we could in company recreate ourselves according to our particular whims and desires. And so we disported ourselves in all manner of ways, called in a body upon other friends, and generally passed hither and thither with no special object in view but that of enjoyment in recreation. The musicians and painters, though music and art is their principal work, also direct their labors into other channels. Consequently, they are full of business and bustling affairs, as we all are. Now we were seated in comfortable chairs beneath the trees upon the lawn of my house, breathing the sweet scented air, with the beautiful gardens round about us, free of every care, chatting merrily upon a wide variety of subjects, and exchanging experiences of every kind. Their range was extensive, as you can well imagine, among such a mixed company whose earthly and spirit world activities were so diversified. Of the whole of our gathering, perhaps the worst off were the musicians, for they were called upon to provide music for our entertainment. The painters, however, by virtue of their profession, claimed instant exemption from any active performance, and they at once became extremely self-satisfied upon the strength of it. As one of them remarked, he would be delighted to paint a picture for us there and then, but as it would take some time to do, since a picture cannot be painted in a moment, it would be as well to make ample provision for someone to carry on our work for us, while we made ourselves as comfortable as possible in preparation for an extremely long session, for he was an extremely slow workman, and tended to become even slower when working in the presence of others. For our further entertainment, we were offered a course of sermons by our clerical friends upon a number of subjects, all of which we resolutely declined without thanks. It seemed therefore that our musicians were the most handicapped of us all, but they enjoyed themselves heartily nonetheless. We were seated thus when Ruth's quick eye perceived two men in the distance evidently coming in our direction. As they proceeded, they paused here and there to look at the flowers, until at length they were sufficiently near for us to identify them. One was a man of commanding presence whose most marked feature was his raven black hair. I first introduced him and his constant companion to you in the very earliest of these writings as the Chaldean and the Egyptian. Since my early days in spirit lands, they have both been my kindest friends, always ready to help and advise upon every occasion and to give me the benefit of their experience gained through a very long, life in the spirit world. At once I went forward to greet our two visitors, who were equally well known to the whole of our present company. We were naturally delighted beyond words that they should have chosen such a moment for their visit. My friends rose in a body upon the approach of our visitors, and there was a free exchange of the most cordial greetings. In the meantime, Ruth and one of the men had disappeared indoors, reappearing shortly after with a special chair which we reserved for such guests. It was a very substantial oaken armchair, heavily carved, and was altogether a great favorite. With many warm expressions the Chaldean seated himself in it, with Ruth at his right hand and the Egyptian at his left. The Chaldean had come, he said, upon business as well as pleasure. At the mention of the word business, our friends made a movement of withdrawing, thinking that he would wish to discuss whatever matter it may be, without other auditors. But the Chaldean would not hear of it, and bade them all be reseated. He understood, he said, that a vast deal of talking had been going on during our assembly, and therefore he felt that a little more would do no harm whatever. The Chaldean, I should add, is a man whose sense of humor is keen, and that to be in his presence is always a mental tonic. He is a living testimony to the fact that those who dwell in the highest realms do not lose their light-heartedness and humor. It was a pity, he said, that we had refused the excellent offer from our colleagues of listening to a sermon or two. As he could see, he added, that the whole company would be none the worse for a little extra spiritual tone. After a further exchange of pleasantries, the Chaldean turned to me and spoke of our prospective writings, of which these present are the accomplishment. He then made the suggestion that perhaps I would favor the insertion of a chapter upon a theme which he had to offer. I expressed my willingness and delight to be of every possible service to him. He voiced his pleasure, and proceeded to outline to me the subject he wished discussed. I was to use my own words, he merely supplying a conspectus. We listened with interest while he set forth the various points of his narration. Some of our company, who were not so conversant with earthly matters as others of us, were saddened by what the Chaldean had to recount. At length the matter was disposed of, and the conversation became our own once more. Our party resumed its lighter temper after the gravity of our visitor's discourse, and being pressed to remain as long as possible, our two visitors joined with us in our mild conviviality, to which the Chaldean's jocundity and wealth of experiences added greatly. Thus we continued. So, before our present company disbands, as it were, each upon his own particular occasions and without further preamble, here is what I was bid to discuss with you. Upon every day, of every week, of every year on earth, the ejaculation goes forth that was reputed to have been made so long, long ago by an angelic host in a little corner of the earth, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men of good will. For how many hundreds of years has that sentence been uttered? And upon how many an occasion has the earth's peace been shattered? The pages of history books are stained with the blood of human beings shed in the countless wars that have assailed the earth, each of them growing more intense, each of them producing an ever-increasing number of victims. With the multiplication of scientific discoveries upon every hand, it seems to have been inevitable that wherever possible those discoveries should be turned to mortal account upon the advent of war. The weapons of war have, in some measure, ceased to be used individually, and have been turned into instruments of wholesale slaughter whose sufferers are counted in thousands of thousands. These are matters upon which you, My good friends, are only too well informed through your own bitter experiences of a recent past, and I thus lay them before you, not to waste your time nor try your patience by telling you of something of which you are fully aware, but because a plain statement of the obvious is sometimes advisable in order to make a chosen theme perfectly clear. Life upon earth has become hazardous. My friends have doubtless asked themselves why it is that, seemingly, war has always existed on earth, and, further, why cannot wars be ended for all time? You would be answered by your neighbor that that is precisely what the leaders of the whole world are now so sedulously trying to do. Now here I want to make a declaration that is as plain and unequivocal, as unyielding and spiritually indisputable, as the words of language can make it. It is a spiritual truth, the profundity of which few leaders on earth have ever bothered to consider with any degree of real seriousness, but which is nevertheless to be found within the prayer books and incorporated in the services of at least one state church. This is it: thou shalt not kill. Look in your prayer books, and you will find that it is placed fifth, on the list of God's commandments. What is the spiritual law governing human earthly life in this respect? In other words, what does the spirit world say? It says just what I have said to you, but in any list of spiritual prohibitions it allots a far higher place than fifth. By what right does man on earth assume to himself the power over life and death, as it is termed? It is the custom on earth to legitimatize the killing of human beings by the passing of enactments. You have witnessed at least one country which dispensed with such legalities in favor of verbal instructions, or the briefest of handwritten documents. So that by incorporating into the laws of a country official permission to kill human beings, that act is made right and proper. Is not that so? It matters not whether the case concerns the individual or whether it concerns a whole nation as a militant force. It is the nature of governments, and of many state-aided churches as well, to regard the people over whom they have assumed authority to consider those people only in relation to the earth world. The earth is essentially, to them, the real world, the material world. It is life, the only life that is known, but scarcely understood. Death of the physical body is, of course, inevitable, they will concede, but with that they are not concerned. It is the church's duty to look after that in the way it deems best, and subject to whatever control and influence the state may exercise in its direction and the appointment of its ministers and dignitaries. There may be a nominal combination of church and state, but the latter has little or no interest in the former. The church is all very well for the pious and other religious-minded folk, and the members of the governing body may say some formal prayer before any official proceedings are opened. It is done as a matter of custom, and little if any significance is placed upon the action. They may pray for guidance in their deliberations, but in the end, they prefer to rely upon their own sage judgment. By every spiritual law, as we are familiar with them in the spirit world, it is wrong to legalize in any form the power of terminating the natural period of any person's life upon earth. To employ the terms of part of an enactment that was responsible for ecclesiastical disunity. In my own native land, no prince, person, prelate, state or potential spiritual or temporal has the right to exercise a manner of power, jurisdiction, superiority, authority, preeminence or privilege over spiritual law of which thou shalt not kill occupies a prominent position. What does the law of earth say in this connection as applied to the individual and to whole nations? In the case of the individual, it says in effect, this person has committed a breach of the law by killing another person. We therefore have no further use for him in this world. We know nothing whatever about the laws of the next world, but the next world must take him and have him. He is too bad for our world. We have judged him, and found him guilty. God will now do the same, albeit we commend his soul to God's mercy. Ostensibly we do this as a deterrent to others, but in truth we wish to be rid of him, because that is the cheapest and most satisfactory way of dealing with him. In the case of nations, it is the custom to settle international disagreements and arguments, where words and negotiation have failed, by recourse to arms. The nations meet one another as circumstances dictate, and the armed forces of the nations, that is to say, its citizens, who are human beings, will proceed to kill each other by such means as may be suitable or available or according to the exigencies of the place and time. This method of dealing with international disputes, failing all peaceful means, is a custom established through such a long period of years as to have no date assignable for its actual incipience. The armed forces have the power given them to kill the enemies of the state. You see, my friends, I am setting down literally the method used by the rulers of your earth to settle the earth's quarrels. It is, go to war, and kill, kill, kill. Hunt the enemy, and kill him. Before I go a step further, you will exclaim to me, that's all very well, but what was to be done? You have seen for yourself, or, at least, we presume you have done so, to what extremes we were forced at the outset of the recent hostilities. We have tried to preserve the world from becoming one vast slave state, and its inhabitants from every kind of bestiality. We represented right as opposed to might. We had to defend our very lives and homes, and try to keep safe a decent world for ourselves and our children. That is your situation as you would describe it to me. Then let me say to you that with it we, of the spirit world, have the fullest sympathy. That you were battling with the worst evil that has yet assailed the earth there is no disputing whatever, and any man who would do otherwise is just plainly a fool. Do not forget, my friends, that we saw more of this evil than ever did you, though you yourselves may have been in the very thick of the fighting. We were able to perceive what forces, unseen by you, and in most cases never dreamt of by you, were at work striving upon the side of wrong. But let me say again that it is still wrong, and ever will be, for man to kill fellow man, for any reason whatsoever. Whatever the reasons, whatever the provocations, it is yet wrong. We must not go against the law of God, which is the spiritual law. There is an old saying, with which you are very familiar, that two blacks do not make a white. That is an everlasting truth, and no new discovery, or other and further spiritual revelation, can alter it or dispose of it, or in any way upset it. But in the case of war, it has become the order that the end justifies the means, a dangerous doctrine. How do wars come about? The history books will inform you upon the political situations that finally led to the outbreak of each war. It is not happy reading, and fully reveals the spiritual blindness of the earth world. Some folk say that if only the teachings of the great soul who is named the Prince of Peace were put into practice absolutely and without default, then wars would end for all time on earth. How is that to be done? Through the influence of their churches? That would seem to be the obvious way. But what of the misdeeds that have been, and are, done in God's name or in that of holy religion? History also tells of those. Have heretics never been burnt at the stake? True, it was the secular arm that actually did the burning, not, of course, the church. The latter only condemned. That is what the church would have you believe. The church could, however, have cried aloud against such barbarities, but did not, because it thought nothing could be too awful in the way of punishment for a heretic. The church once had powerful jurisdiction. It can do nothing now but utter moral condemnation, which it seldom does. When it does, it is never heeded. The church must bow to the state, which is, perhaps, just as well when burnings at the stake are called to mind. In turning to the scriptures for a code of moral behavior, you must carry in your mind the diversified interpretations of those scriptures which have resulted in Christian disunity. You will perhaps say that the commandment, love one another, needs no interpretation, and you would be undeniably right. This subject of scriptural interpretation has already been discussed with you elsewhere. All that I will say now upon this point is that the scriptures do not contain all that the great teacher spoke, and that the great bulk of his teachings are not contained within the covers of the book which is universally used on earth at this day. Had the full text been retained and omissions supplied, Perhaps a very different story might have been told of the Earth's subsequent spiritual journey through the ages. War under any designation must forever remain spiritually condemned, whether it be punitive, aggressive, or for other causes that need no enumerating.